Good afternoon. Tuesday, 5 o'clock in the UK, and welcome to What Comes Next Live. Each week we talk to a leader and just see inside what's happening in their head in a conversation about what's happening now and what comes next. Really pleased to talk to one of the most fundamentally active humans I've ever met. Always got lots on the go. And my good friend, Mr. Mark Beaumont, who was our first guest 60 guests ago, in the middle of 2020. And I thought it'd be fun just to bring Mark back on and find out a little bit about, what's gone on for him in the last year plus, and, what he's seeing now, for himself and what he's up to and what he's seeing in terms of people he interacts with and what's happening in the world. So from London, southern edge of London, a very warm welcome to North Edinburgh. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing good. I'm doing great. Good to see you again, albeit over the wire. Yeah. You'll be disappointed when I tell you that.
At some point. I was going to say, I'll make it to Scotland at some point, I promise.
Yeah, no, it's life's good up here. There's worse places to have been during the last 20 months in COVID. Will you be disappointed if I say I've done absolutely nothing since we last spoke?
You'd be lying, though. But what do you mean by nothing?
Well, I don't know. I'm interested to know what you want to know about. It's been a fascinating year for many reasons. And for family, for community, for work, it's been challenging. It's been fulfilling. And it's been a fantastic year. I think I'll reflect on 2020, 2021 is a real period of transition. I think most people will. And, it's allowed me to expedite some of the things which I wanted to do anyway in my career, but I was maybe too busy to prioritize. So when the world stops spinning for a period, which is what happened in 2020, you're helped with that ability to say no. Because things just aren't happening, and it just creates time. It just creates time to do things which you otherwise wanted to do. And so I think I'm not there yet, but I think I'll look back in 5-10 years and go, actually, there was a lot of good things. There was a lot of silver linings from that period because, you know, it allowed me to focus on things I was passionate about but didn't have time for.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really interesting because if I recall, and I think we've spoken once or twice max since we spoke a year plus ago on the show because there's a lot going on. But I remember you were doing some really cool things while the world stopped spinning, such as taking one of your daughters to ride bikes around every road in Edinburgh, which is a good thing to do to get out of the house. But also a lot of what you've been busy doing for years before had been public speaking at different engagements. And of course that all completely stopped. So it just occurs to me there's an interesting phrase that was used by Trotsky after the 1917 Russian Revolution and the war that came with it, which is that war is the locomotive of history. And it's interesting you're noting this has accelerated things you were looking to do.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of – it's certainly not been the most if you deem your success as profitability, then it's certainly, like most businesses, not been the most profitable period in my working history. But that's not really how I define my impact on the world. Clearly, you need to be able to get by. But I wouldn't have – I mean, I'm 38 years old now. I wouldn't have lived the life I'd led if the sum total of my ambition was to – buy a house and have a mortgage. I've always liked difficult projects. I've always liked that sort of pioneering, trying to do things that have not been done before. I always like working in performance teams. And clearly I've done that as an athlete. I've done it as a broadcaster. I'm now doing it as an investor. I advise on a number of really interesting companies. And I'd got to that point because I had a public profile where I was very, very busy doing things that were paying the bills now, but weren't really creating a legacy or an impact in the way that motivated me. So I could see this sort of very obvious trap of having had a very successful career, having a profile that goes with that. And I could have just spent the next 10, 20 years singing for my supper. And, you know, 2019 doing well over 100 events, it was hard to say no. And clearly anyone who is successful in life needs to get very good at saying no. And it's an interesting sort of trick or trait, because you think it's about sort of positivity goes with saying yes and being open to ideas and being entirely collaborative, but actually in terms of your own sort of health and happiness and well-being, especially when you've got family, you've got to be able to sort of figure out very clearly what your priorities are and have time to think and to have time to really invest, not just in sort of the busyness of life, but things which take proper, you know, proper commitment and time. You know, creating major projects is not something like answering emails or having meetings. You know, it's that period of, I'm really going to invest in something because it's going to pay dividends in the future. And again, I'm not talking about financially. So what's happened in the last year? I've continued to be an athlete. I'll always be an athlete. And I think people assume that you'll sort of fall off a cliff at the end of that and then do something else. But I think to continue to do the things that you first met me to do is important, but it's about sort of taking that same energy and putting it into very, very different workflows.
I was thinking about pausing for a minute before we move into talking about how that's changed. Because the things you said were pretty profound. Just to echo them, one is the power of saying no when you're thinking about being abundant, right? And it is really powerful. You know, it's really powerful to know what to say yes to, what to say no to, not to just say yes to everything. I work a lot with corporate leaders and they struggle with that a lot. And the language I'll use with them, the more senior they get, is the less you do, the more valuable you are to your business.
Yeah.
Because then they've got time to think. So what you're saying at 38 years old is, and I feel really old hearing you say you're 38 because I've known you quite a while. It's like, but that's a level of maturity and awareness that is not often present in people 10, 20 years older than you in their business careers. The other part that I would kind of spin a little differently is that profitability, there is the difference between the profit you make on the income statement, or P&L, we call it in the UK, which is this year's profit. And there's the profit you make by investing for future year returns, which is really the balance sheet and the beyond the balance sheet.
Yeah.
And some of those things take years to reach maturity. So I know you and I worked on a project, 3 or 4 years ago, and didn't come to fruition, but I love the fact you had the vision that was one potential idea you could have to transition. And so there's a major project such as going around the world in 78 days and 14 hours, if I remember correctly. So 80 days is not enough. So 78 days is a lot better, apparently. And that's a massive project. It took years to plan and took 80 days. But you're embarking on a project now, which will see shifts occurring for decades to come. So yeah, I mean, the work you're doing now is going to pay dividends and profits for a long time. And yeah, so that's a metaphor for others as well.
But I think I really don't want to focus on financial gains, because clearly to not have money makes you very unhappy and life very stressful. Yeah. But I think when you start out in your career, you know, it's natural to be looking over your shoulder. It's naturally to be figuring out how you fit into the system and trying to keep tracks. But as life goes on, you very quickly lose track, and it very much comes about, you know, how do you create positive memories? How do you create a positive impact? You know, what gives you a sense of worth? So I think clearly people get to this point at different ages and stages, but you're absolutely right. The opportunity cost is really about how you spend your time. Mm-hmm. And what you were describing there is, you know, short-term gains versus, you know, long-term security, if you like, which is absolutely fundamentally important. But that's an output at the end of the day. It's not an input. The only thing you control is your time and your effort. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you make money along the way is an output from those efforts. So if you're motivated by the output, it goes back to the sporting analogy, you know, you can control your power. You can control the time you spend doing that effort. You can't actually control the speed you go, or you can't actually control, you know, the time that you complete the because there'll be headwinds. Yeah. There'll be tough road conditions. There'll be hills. And I think that is a very useful metaphor for life. You know, there's no, you can put a consistent effort in through life. You can get ruthlessly good at, you know, allocating your time. How successful you are, quote unquote, defined by yourself or others, is so much more complicated than your inputs. It's, you know, luck. It's the conditions of the road. It's whether you have headwinds or tailwinds. You know, we've all hit COVID in the last 18 months, but, you know, it's not affected us all the same. So I'm very pragmatic about the fact that, you know, all I can do is control my inputs. All I can do is wake up every week, you know, with a clear idea of what's important, what I'm going to do. Say no to the stuff that's noise. And clearly, you know, with young family at home and with a better connection to the community I'm a part of, that has become a more significant part of my life over the last couple of years, which is something, you know, which, as I say, has been sort of put into, you know, it's been made a lot easier by the fact that there's been less demands on my time to jump on a jet plane and go to America every week.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, okay, cool. And if I stretch the metaphor a bit, if you're putting the same inputs in, you know, the strategic bit might be, I don't need to cycle over that mountain range. I can go around it. All right. But sometimes we just follow the well-trodden path, right? So you're doing some different stuff now. You're doing, you just mentioned that you were doing one of those Tough Mudder races at the weekend. So you're doing still doing a lot of athletic stuff. You did Land's End to John O'Groats recently, didn't you? If I remember right, on the ground.
Three times this summer.
Three times this summer. Yeah, why not?
That's another story. It's normally Land's End John O'Groats is such a bucket list event for most keen bike riders. And I'm not going to explain why I ended up doing it three times in the summer, but it's quite ridiculous considering my job is not being a full-time athlete anymore. It was quite ridiculous to find myself in June, July and August trying to break different records and win different races with the same. And it's a classic, like, you can clip my wings. I can't fly across to do expeditions on the other side of the planet, but Land's End John O'Groats is as far as you can go in the UK. And so to end up doing it three times in the summer, even to myself, seemed a little bit ridiculous.
What were you saying yes to?
What with those events?
Well, if one of the key things you focus on is saying no to the right things, what were you saying yes to?
Well, people assume that I always said when I finished cycling around the world the second time, around the world in 80 days, that was my Everest. I've said that to you before. I will never do anything bigger, harder, mm-hmm. you know, more committed than that. So there's an assumption that I'll just retire. That's the last chapter and I'll create a completely new chapter. You know, so many athletes fall off a cliff and then have to reinvent themselves. I don't think that way. I would be an athlete if it wasn't my job. A, because it's good for the soul. And B, being very commercial about it, it's quite useful having a public profile. Mm-hmm. So I do these things because I enjoy being a broadcaster and sharing what I do. And it's a smaller part of what I do. It's less than a quarter of my time now, but it's very seasonal. So I will still have major projects each summer that, you know, get me out there. A, I find them very fulfilling. They give me something to train for throughout the year, but also it's amazing how useful it is having that credibility. And it's a weird metaphor, but like, I've made my career in breaking records, doing firsts, mm-hmm. and working in performance teams. So even though my other work as a business advisor, as an investor, as a fund manager is a completely different sort of focus in terms of workflow. Mm-hmm. People seem to think that there's this sort of pixie dust that you can take from one to another. They sort of say, oh, you're the record breaking guy, so therefore you can do record breaking wherever you go. Now, clearly that doesn't carry. You have to learn your skills and learn your trade, and it's a very different skill set. But when I meet people and I talk about backing Scottish innovation, finding businesses that are having a positive impact in the world in quality of life, or you know, climate change issues, or food and water security. You know, these are fundamental problems, challenges of our day, global issues, which you need, you know, really knowledge intensive innovation to help address and fix. Weirdly, having a background and a track record of getting stuff done, even though it's in a very different walk of life, it's amazing what confidence that gives people. And they go, okay, I know that you're somebody who's got a strong track record of seeing things through, of getting stuff done. And if you say that you've put together a good team and you trust this team and you're working with them, it's amazing how that sort of carries. So I'm not suggesting that, you know, just because you cycle around the world in record breaking time, you'll be a good investor. But it's interesting, you know, I'm interested in people, and people buy into people. And I go out there every year and push myself as an athlete, even if the cameras weren't on, because I love it. It's deeply important to me, and I'll do it for as long as I'm physically able. But it is interesting how those actions and those projects still open up interesting conversations when I'm talking to, you know, inventors, entrepreneurs, investors, and the rest of it. There's, believe it or not, there's a commonality between those two worlds.
Yeah. It's funny, two things. First is, you said I'm interested in people, and it takes me back to the time you came out to Cayman when I was living there, because you were working for, I think, the BBC, going all around the world, seeing the Commonwealth Games torch for Glasgow 2014.
That's right.
And I went out on a bike ride with you, and I just remember going down this amazing scenery with a good friend of mine. And the two of you were riding side by side, and I was just tucked in behind you. And I just remember thinking, the scenery is incredible, and Mark is just completely focused on the person he's talking to. He's not looking at the scenery at all.
Yeah.
It's like, so interested in people. And as to the skills, yeah, I mean, it's interesting piece. It's like doing some of what you're referring to as projects, your sort of athletic endeavors. They keep you in the public eye. So they open the door to conversations, and at which point once people, so people are watching or listening to this, at any point in time, and the other conversation we had, that I would anticipate they kind of quite quickly pick up, yeah, I'd quite like to talk to this guy. And if you were an inventor or an investor or seeking investment, now that phase, they go, right, he's, you know, he knows what it takes to relate to people and to get things done. So with that segue, tell us a little bit, because you just gave a little group of highlights about the investment fund and the group you're working with, and what that's focused on, because I've not spoken to you about that for a while, and I remember being introduced to it by you a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I think you came along to one of the events we did in London just before the world stopped spinning. Yeah, I'm a partner with a company called EOS Advisory. EOS is the Greek goddess of the dawn. So we're all about seed stage, that point of incorporation, taking great ideas, often from university spin-outs, but sometimes from industry as well. And how do you put the right teams, the right structure, the right finance, the right plan behind innovation? But innovation fundamentally, which is motivated to make a positive impact on the world. I'm a firm believer that if you're addressing, you know, a really pressing issue, then clearly there's early stage risks. But the scale of the opportunity to fix one of these big problems, you know, the returns, and I, by returns, I mean financial returns and positive impact,
yes,
are commensurate with that early stage risk. So, you know, you have to at some level be altruistically motivated by the idea that you can affect change.
Yep.
You can not just acknowledge and live with these challenges. And there's four buckets, there's four areas that I'm sort of particularly focused on. The healthcare sector, which is around disease diagnosis and therapeutics. Clean technology. So that's in the space of renewables, climate change issues and related technologies. The third one is around food and water security. And that's really been put into sharp focus over the last 18 months as borders have closed. Mm-hmm. As you realize, you know, the UK is, we don't realize how vulnerable we are in terms of food security. Well, we do, because we walk into our supermarkets and we find our shelves are empty. You know, we are entirely reliant on that global trade. And, you know, how do you create enough protein for a growing global population? You know, how do you make sure, will there be wars in the future over clean water? Mm. You know, these are things which I think about and I want to be able to in some way to influence change over. And the last area is, And I don't just believe in, you know, creating new technologies for new, you know, new ways of living. I think you have to address the way that we live our lives now. So we're not all going to suddenly transition to renewables overnight. Oil and gas still exists. And there's huge efficiencies to be created through current industries. So I will, and my team will invest in innovation and technologies which clean up, bring new thinking, bring efficiencies into major industry. If it progresses and, as it says, in some way, you know, creates impact, positive change within that. So I'm not just going to put money into things which are brand new, shiny, fresh, you know, future proof. I think there's a massively important transition that we're going through at the moment, where we have to take current industries and evolve them into where we're going to be 5, 10, 15 years down the line. I worry with the whole net zero, you know, COP26 agenda that there's this never ever land which keeps disappearing off into the future. And people aren't actually thinking about the changes that need to be made here and now, and the fact that that's a process as opposed to a moment in time where we're just going to sort of land on the solutions and the future technology. So future technologies are very powerful, you know, hydrogen and, you know, you name it. These are all very exciting technologies, but actually there's huge efficiencies to be had within older technologies to make sure that we can transition effectively. So, and Scotland is such a fantastic hotbed for innovation, and it always has been. You know, we've got very strong relationships with the 12 Scottish universities and laboratories all over the country. But it's a very underserved. I don't think a lot of Scottish innovation has the opportunity to scale quickly into global markets. They often stay Scottish. So these are the bits that I'm passionate about, and I've got a great team that will work with me.
It's very exciting. I remember going to that presentation before the world stopped spinning as fast. And that linkage to those Scottish universities, I thought was fantastic. And we're both Scots, so it was a very, very cool piece. To the last sector you were talking about, before I got on this call, I was having a CEO level conversation with a North American leader. And one of the conversations was about the increasing polarization in the world, and we don't, not just politics, but as you referred to, like COP26 could descend into never ever land and always kicking a can down the road. And it links to your thought around inputs and outputs. And you know, the word I like is the word more. Can we do more? Can we do more? Can we improve? Can we move along in that direction? Because if an institutional investor turns to CEO and says, I don't want you working with these clients because they have 5% of their stuff in oil and gas, then what about the 95% of stuff that they're looking to improve? And just a tiny last piece is, went car shopping for somebody earlier this summer, and I hadn't bought a car for a very, very long time. And this was a perfectly decent, serviceable family car, all right? 3 years old or something, right? The engine was 0.9 liters, twin turbocharged, 3-cylinder, and it got 60 something miles to the gallon of petrol. And the CO2 emissions were infinitesimal. And that can be bought off from a dealer 3 years old for £10,000. If you want a 3-year-old e-Golf from Volkswagen, it's about £30,000 for a pure electric vehicle. So, but if you buy one of those 0.9 liter cars, that would barely run a motorbike when I was a kid, right? So you're actually able to have a family car that is so much cleaner and more efficient than they were 10. And you know, the sales guy was just going, yeah, the changes we've seen in this industry in just the last 10, 15 years, which effectively is old technology. Nobody brags about having a petrol engine car.
No.
But when you can have one that's actually doing so much less damage to the environment and doesn't need lithium batteries to be mined and several hundred kilos worth of them stuck underneath the floor pan of the car, there is a lot. So there's an example of how much room there is to improve, to do more with what we already have, while also looking at those very, very cool new areas that you're looking at.
So definitely. That's a really good sort of domestic choice, which, you know, so many people are are thinking about at the moment, you know, to lengthen the life of things which have already been created, to reuse responsibly, you know, to move away from that disposable economy, you know, versus, you know, adopting new technologies. I mean, these are conversations I have with my daughters all the time. Really important.
It's cool. So that's the main thing you're focused on now in for yourself beyond the public face stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd say if I was to map out the last 3 months, just to give you a snapshot, we smashed the, Land's End John O'Groats relay in 39 hours and 40 minutes. So if you're a bike rider, averaging 23 miles an hour nonstop from Land's End to John O'Groats. So, you know, still passionate about that stuff. In fact, as we record this, I know people are going to listen to this in the future, but we're recording this on the 21st of September. And today a documentary came out on GCN Plus about trying to break those records this summer. But that's on one side. On the other side, raised our first EIS fund, successfully started investing that. And as sort of a passion project on the side, I'm writing my sixth book, which is about sports psychology.
Ooh. Sorry, I'm excited by that.
Yeah, I know. I'm finding it quite interesting. I published a book last year called Endurance, which was about a how-to book answering all the frequently asked questions, yeah. You know, for everything from nutrition to training to bike fit to you name it. And the chapter I enjoyed writing the most was with Laura Penhall, my performance manager and co-author, was psychology. And there was a guy called Dr. Jim Taylor, based over in California, who was my sort of inspiration for that chapter. And when the publisher got back in touch and said, look, that's doing really well. Would you like to write another book? I said, I don't have a lot of time to write another book, but I would love to continue to write. And if I was to write, I would definitely pick up on the psychology mindset piece. So I got back in touch with Jim, who'd been a key contributor, and said, look, would you kind of lead on this project? He doesn't have the profile to maybe sell the book in, but I can sell the book in. And then I said, could you give the bare bones there? He's worked with top flight US ski team, triathlon, cyclist, you know, you name it, but very much from the psychologist's perspective. And then I can bring it to life, you know, through a lifetime of pushing the envelope. So he's ended up doing the heavy lifting on the book, maybe 75% of it. But then I need to very much come in and make sense of his theories and his coaching. So I'm really enjoying it. I need to get it finished by mid-November. So that's taking up some of my evenings at the moment.
And that I'm excited to read it when it comes out, because every time you and I have talked, you know, I'm always just fascinated by understanding that psychology piece. And anybody who's watched the, particularly watched the documentaries around your record attempts and record successes, you know, the most bits people always remember are the points of struggle. I know you're involved with GCN now in Global Cycling Network, and I think the most amazing thing I've ever seen online from you was the interview you gave to a couple of the guys directly after you'd done the 80 days record, and they just could not conceive of the timeframes you were looking at in terms of like having a really major injury really early in the ride.
Yeah.
It's going, yeah, well, after a couple of weeks, you don't feel the pain.
It was pretty bad.
It was at that moment. I think it was Simon who was like, just couldn't believe what you were saying. And just couldn't fathom it. And, it was that moment. I just kind of thought you've definitely echoed this a lot is that you pretty much invented or gave credence and credibility to the competitive cycling fraternity. The ultra endurance cycling is a sport in and of itself.
It's definitely come a long way in the last 15 years. When I started endurance cycling, it was just seen as touring. It was just seen as trekking. And now, you know, it's legitimate, you know, ultra endurance racing. I'm certainly not taking credit for all of that, but it's been a privilege to sort of have my professional career sort of in that, you know, those worlds have come very much together. Ultra endurance, road racing. And it's interesting. So in August, I took 2 weeks off the day job, the office job, and took part in GB Duro, which is an off-road race the length of Britain. And 250 people applied to take part for 60 start places. So you had to have a pretty strong palmarès, a pretty strong CV to even get selected to be on the start line. It's then a gravel race, self-supported, self-sufficient, and it kind of harks back to where Grand Tour racing started back in the day. So back in, say, 1903 with the Tour de France, where it was in these massive long stages, self-supported gravel roads. So unlike modern stage racing where, you know, the races at the stages are relatively short and it's massively supported and it's got a huge carbon footprint, you know, the ethos of this event is this is where racing started. This is racing at its rawest. And it's self-supported, no fly rules to the start, leave no trace, you know, really, really strong on its ethics. And anywho, 60 people stood on the start line. Only 14 finished. Only 14 finished. By the time we got out of Wales halfway through the race, half the field had quit. Now, there was a lot of pros in there. There was a lot of top amateurs, people with huge experience, round the world cyclists, and 14 out of 60 got to the end. And most of them, they didn't quit because their bikes broke. They didn't quit because they physically couldn't carry on. They were ill. Most of them scratched because ultimately, their, you know, the willpower to carry on, you know, the magnitude of what they were taking on and the sheer never endingness of it just became greater than their willpower to carry on. And they all had very good reasons, you know, they all had very good reasons, but that level of attrition is just extraordinary. I mean, it is legitimately one of the hardest bike races on the planet, but it was just amazing to see a community of people just pitting themselves through sleep deprivation, ultra endurance. I mean, the first stage alone was, you know, 400 miles nonstop. And then you sleep in a field in the rain in mid Wales and then crack on for the next stage. So it's amazing to have lived through that and seen, like, those that finished weren't necessarily the strongest rider. Last weekend, I went out for a ride with the oldest finisher. He was, Howard Perkins. He was, 59 years old. And you can't tell me he was the strongest, fittest, fastest, best qualified rider in the field. He wasn't. But sorry about this. The thing that he had was just an unbreakable will to complete, and just a real reliance in his own ability, which I think's inspiring. And I think that's where, you know, we don't live in a meritocracy. Those that do well have that ability to endure, whether it's in business or in sport.
Hmm. Well, that's a fantastic note, perhaps, to finish on, because we could always talk for hours about these things. Because, yeah, when you're now investing in entrepreneurs with early stage ideas. That's another thing you bring to it, is not blind endurance, but the ability to work out, well, what can I utilize? What resources can I tap into? In order to continue, what inputs can I give that are beyond the physical? Yeah. So the sports psychology is totally fascinating. And I've always, every time I listen to you talk about these things, I learn something new, because I love working with people striving to be elite. And elite's not about money and it's not about time on the clock, but it's just about that level of performance that goes beyond what most people can conceive of.
Yeah. And that's what you look for in founders. You know, yes, you need good ideas. Yes, you need IP. Yes, you need the ability to have a good, you know, but ultimately you're backing the ability not to give up. You got to look somebody in the eye and go, can you weather a storm or two? And that's not about academic smarts. Mm-mm. You know, that's purely about experience, quiet confidence, all the things you've heard me talk about before. So
fantastic. Well, anybody who listens to this or watches this later, who's looking for EOS to invest in them, they have to be ready to sit across the table from the guy who went around the world in 78 days and who finished the GB Duro this summer. And when he says, do you have what it takes to not give up?
Hopefully I'm not that scary.
No, you're not at all scary. Which is cool. Wonderful to talk to you, Mark. With that, we'll try to keep the discipline of only going on for roughly half an hour.
Superb. Well, it's always great to catch up. We'll see you soon.
Thank you for leading and being our first return guest. So, and I do hope to see you soon. Cheers.
Cheers.